them up one at a time. It was really easy to get through. And, you know, after I had my short QSO with him, how to say he was calling CQ and nobody was answering him.
Well, you were a lucky guy. You say it's Fernando de Noronha?
Yeah. FERNANDODENORONHA.
Okay, I'm looking it up. It says it consists of 21 islands and islets.
Well, you know, you'll get your DXCC, you know, you got to work a whole bunch of those islands.
Okay, well, you know, congratulations that you're working them. You know, sometimes people just aren't listening, either because they can't or they're doing something else. So, fortunately, so you made contact with this guy.
QSL, we didn't confirm yet. 59... to say the expedition, 20 meters, probably about an hour ago, maybe a little more, 14.228, upper side bend.
Okay, very good. I am looking it up. It says it's famous for diving and snorkeling. Unfortunately, you can't do that via radio.
Well, you know, people can do all kinds of things, you know, they want to try something different. You know, I can give you his call sign if you want.
Sure.
Papa X-Ray Zero Foxtrot Foxtrot.
Okey-doke. I wrote it down. I'll look it up on QRZ when I have a chance. Very good.
Well, you know, Roy, I'm a big fan of QRZ pages. I like to read them. You know, before I call anyone, I look on their QRZ page, so at least I know that we might have something to talk about.
Well, that's a good practice. Usually, if I'm unfamiliar with a person, I will kind of go into the QRZ, because I wrote a bunch of stuff about myself, and sometimes people do the same thing. Other times, I've gone to pages that are completely empty, unfortunately. But I mean, I think that's fine and good and completely understandable. I told the story before. There's this interesting fellow out of Arizona who I was talking to him, and he was discussing the layout of the rooms in my house. He apparently plays around in real estate, so he went on the Zillow site and got a kind of a copy of my floor plan to kind of comment upon. That I thought was a bit weird.
I wonder about that. Did he think that there was something in it for him?
No, it was just a conversation. He thought he could make a comment about how many square feet I have. By the way, Frank, you doubled with Frank, WB2BXO, who's coming in through Echolink. Frank, what would you like to say?
Yeah, I think PX0FF, I just saw in the AOL, DX newsletter. I think he's done tomorrow. Tomorrow's the 20th. He may still be on tomorrow. They say he's on through the 21st. He's fairly easy to work. I said I've worked him on a bunch of bands. And for those who chase paper, that's actually not super rare. Anyway, that's... he's on, and Noro, C21, Mike, was interested in the expedition. I think he's on through the end of the month. that one piece also, they're also relatively easy to work. Oh, and then Vanuatu was on. I was actually supposed to go on that one, but went down. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. But here in Brooklyn, it's October 20th. Oh, I guess this is his last day.
Oh, okay, you're right. For some reason or other, I wasn't looking at the date. I'm thinking for some reason it's the... yep. Yeah, I don't have my reading glasses on. Sorry. Anyway... So I think he's pretty much done. I don't think I saw him on this evening. And my buddy on the West Coast has been complaining he's never come above his noise level, which actually surprised me a bit. But he's in an apartment with a very high noise level, so that's actually probably not too surprising, unfortunately.
Okay, well, fortunately, David was able to make contact with him, so congratulations to David on that. And thanks for expanding our understanding of the situation, Frank.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I figured out how to set up a noise blanking system on my radio. Makes it really easy to hear.
Pray tell.
Well, how do I describe it? You turn on the notch filter, you turn the dial for the contour, and it's a combination between notch and contour.
Okay, I mean, that's something that you can do. If the noise is amenable to being pulled out that way without too much of the signal itself, I have found, unfortunately, very often that no matter how you configure a notch filter, you are going to kind of remove part of the signal itself. Whether you can kind of reconstruct it in your head or not depends on a whole bunch of things. But, you know, notches are not solely affecting noise. They affect the signal as well. The contour maybe helps a little bit, but it's still the signal itself is certainly not pristine in my experiences.
I don't know. On this radio, it seems to work really good. I compare it to other radios, you know, having the press, then turn on the notch filter and turn the dial for the contour. And I guess what it does is it takes the noise out of the signal pretty much. And it's crazy like that. If the signal isn't loud enough, then I have to turn on the DNR. DNR has 15 algorithmic settings, you know, for different kinds of noise, and I find setting number 5 and number 6 seem to work best for me.
Okay, I mean, DNR is a much more sophisticated, complicated type of situation. With a notch filter, you're basically setting the center frequency, the attenuation, max, and the slope of both sides. That's the contour. Is basically the same as saying the slope. So if it's a steep slope, it's a sharp cutoff, and if it's a more gradual cutoff, then it's a, you know, it's a wider type of thing. Sometimes these noise reduction circuits are helpful. My Flex radio has never been particularly known for their noise reduction algorithms. I've tried every which one of them and never been particularly thrilled with the ability that they had. They promised years and years ago to kind of boost the process, but they never got around to it. Maybe now that they have a new set of models, they'll spend a little bit more time tweaking the noise reduction algorithms.
What do you know about roofing filter 3 kilohertz?
Not that much. My radios don't have roofing filters, you know, because they're SDRs. Analogs in the old days had roofing filters, and you could adjust them and change them. But they offered a little bit more selectivity, separation and such.
Well, you know, I find that the width function, WDH, is what it's called, and you can change the bandwidth from 500 kilohertz up to 4,000, I'm sorry, 500 hertz to 4,000 hertz. I think that's right. And I find that when I expand and I open it to 4.0 kilohertz, you know, the quality, the fidelity goes up. And how to say that it's adjustable here, too.
Okay, I mean, you're talking about a bandpass filter where, you know, most single sideband signals are approximately 2.7 kilocycles, give or take. Some people run a little bit wider, 3.3. There's crazy people with extended single sideband where it could be a bandwidth of 6 kilocycles. Depending upon the bandwidth of the signal you're receiving, if you narrow the reception bandwidth, you'll probably lessen some of the noise and end up with less fidelity. Depending upon how you adjust it, usually what it does is it takes away the high end. So your sibilances are kind of lost, and it's much lower type of frequency contours and such. But, you know, people do that also all the time. Sometimes I have some interference off frequency, and by narrowing the passband, I can get rid of that QRM and, you know, suffer a slightly diminished fidelity. But, you know, I'm not listening to music here. I'm just listening to someone's voice.
This one goes from 300 hertz to 4.0 kilohertz in, I think, maybe 100 or so increments, 100 cycle increments. You know, this radio also has some kind of cool things. One is IPO, which is preamp, and ATT, which is attenuator. You have 3-4 settings for attenuator and 2 or 3 settings for IPO.
Yeah, the more adjustments, usually the better if you know what you're doing with them. There are cases where I talk to people who are so nearby that it kind of blows a hole almost in my front end, and I use the attenuator. So it you'll have less internal distortions that the circuitry has to deal with. So attenuations can be useful, especially if you have nearby people you're talking to. If you're talking to people across the world, you're not going to really be using an attenuator that much, most likely. But who knows? Propagation works in mysterious ways.
Tell me if I'm wrong. If I attenuate 6 dB and my IPO is the preamplifier is set to be on medium level, not high level, could that make a difference in the signal as opposed to noise and clarity?
Unfortunately, no. It depends upon what frequency you're operating on. If you're operating on UHF and VHF, most of the noise is internal noise to your radio electronics, which are, you know, thermal and otherwise. At HF frequencies, the overwhelming majority of your noise is being received. So if you attenuate 6 decibels, you will attenuate your signal 6 decibels and your noise 6 decibels for the most part.
Well, wait a second, you know, significantly, this is a hybrid radio. It has RF function parts in it, you know, and it has SDR functions in the receiver, you know. And maybe, you know, I come to the feeling that ATT, if I bring it up a little bit and I bring the IPO up a little bit, somehow it changes the relation between the signal and the noise. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, if someone else wanted to say something, so we'll give a little space for them to say it. I mean, it's within the realm of possibilities that without the proper attenuation, you're overloading some circuit. And so it's not a matter of attenuating the signal versus the noise. You're just going to generate more noise if you're overdriving a component. So maybe that's what's going on when you're doing the attenuation. The other person who was trying to talk, please hit that push to talk and stay with your piece.
It's KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
David's conversation brought up an interesting thought in my mind that I had heard about this past week, and I was wondering if anybody could make some comments on. He was talking about guitar audio and strings and tones and whatnot. And I heard a reference to a guitar likened to an offset of a dipole when you strike a string up close to the neck as opposed to down by where you normally strike it. Resonates at a different frequency, and the example given was likening it to an offset effect dipole's activity, and I was wondering, and I've been studying this subject for quite some time, and it still confuses the hell out of me. I was wondering if there was any commentary on that concept.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't know exactly how to explain it. They're both waves. One's electromagnetic and operates through conductors, wire, and the other is acoustic and operates through material. Could be conducting, could be insulating, because it's just mechanically vibrating up and down as opposed to currents of electricity undulating back and forth on it. So, I mean, to a degree, there's wave-like properties in both of these things that are very, very similar. The medium is different. The rates at which they operate are different. But wave phenomena can often describe a lot of different things that occur through wave mechanics. And acoustical guitars and antennas both operate through wave mechanics.
Is there a difference between the nylon strings and the metal strings? Metal strings usually are magnetic pickups, and like the piezo pickup, it works on the vibrations in the parts of the guitar.
Yes, but it's more selective. It will only operate in sensing the movement of the strings itself. So you wouldn't have that feedback mechanism that you see sometimes with your piezoelectric detectors, which will pick up any kind of acoustic wave bouncing up against it and create a voltage potential.
KG2RY. Yeah. I was reading about it. They talk about the certain kinds of piezo pickups for guitar. Yeah, you can also use a piezo pickup for steel string guitars, even electric guitars. And piezo pickup usually needs some kind of preamplification before it gets into an amplifier.
Yeah.
What I was wondering is, it seems like when you pluck a string on a guitar, which is an acoustical antenna in an analogy, whether you strike it in the middle or where you normally strike it down on the, I don't know the word for it, or if you strike it up by the neck, is there some parallel to a off-center dipole there that creates a multi-resonant device? Am I trying to compare technologies that really have nothing to do with one another, or do they?
AC2GS. Well, again, they both work as a wave mechanics. But the problem is that with acoustic waves, I think if you feed it, if you don't constrain the string, the only thing that is determined by the location where you pluck it is amplitude. The effect of exchange of energies is probably greatest at the center of the string than at the edges. So if you constrain the edges, then you're going to shift the resonance. But as long as you don't constrain any part of the string, it should maintain the same frequency resonance. It's simply the energy transfer that's different, depending upon whether you pluck it in the middle or pluck it towards the sides.
My electric guitar is visible to me, and from our pickup, it's in the middle of the guitar. I agree. Inside the sound opening. Agree, or is there something else going on? Nylon string guitar with the piezo pickup. The pickup is mounted in the bridge, which is at the bottom of the guitar.
Okay, I mean, it just has to be able to hear the vibrations of the guitar case and such, and that's not a problem. Unfortunately, Jim, David kind of doubled with you, so would you like to try and say what you said before? Because I didn't quite understand it because David was also talking.
What I was saying was your electronic description of the circumstances seems reasonable. I was wondering if the autistic folks in the crowd, from their experience with actually making guitar work, which I don't have, agree or disagree with that perspective.
Okay, I'll throw it out to the audience. I don't know if we have that many musicians out there. My other technical, Matt, has a musician, but I don't. But if anyone out there knows how to pluck a guitar and would like to teach us a few things about it, please hit that push to talk.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul?
Yeah, when I was a kid, we had an F-pole guitar. So it had no pickup, no anything. But, you know, back then you thought nothing of buying one and attaching it to the guitar. And it worked great. It was magnetic because it was steel strings. And it worked quite well. But, you know, just had the regular mono plug that you plugged into the amplifier and you were good to go. So I don't have any experience with the piezoelectric ones. But you know, that's what we used to do. Nowadays, I don't even know if you could buy them, you know, for a guitar like that anymore. That's, you know, as an aftermarket thing, maybe they do have that. But, you know, right now you go out and buy it and everything's already attached to the guitar. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. Do you have any recollections of how the sound quality was if you plucked it from either end of the device? My surmise would be the best energy transfer would be somewhere near the middle.
I didn't see any. You know, I mean, you're not going to go up on the neck, you know. But, no, it was generally, you know, within that 4 to 6 inch area, you know, anywhere near the pickup. Well, it didn't matter, you know, the pickup was going to pick it up no matter what. But I don't, you know, I'm not going to say it was any louder if you went one way or another on the string. Not that I recall. Then we had the treble arm. That was great, too. You push that back and forth. And wah, 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 wah noise. You know, that was great. But no, I don't remember any noticeable difference. Back to you.
Okay. Well, I never tried the guitar. I got in a music class in junior high school, I guess because, unfortunately, I passed the ability. They tested whether we were tone deaf or not, and I wasn't tone deaf enough to not be given music class, and so I ended up with the trumpet of all things, which, I don't know, I didn't get very far on the trumpet. Anyway, I think time is running out, so unless anyone has any comments to make, we probably should be moving on.
You know, Roy, thank you very much for this discussion. I just want to say that I also have a mountain dulcimer. I mounted a piezoelectric pickup on the dulcimer, and it records really good.
Yeah, very good. Must sound lovely.
Roy, you'll enjoy knowing that I failed miserably at the trumpet also. Go on to the next segment.
Okay, I know. Yeah, well, we're two of the same kind that way. I mean, if my orchestra had fourth trumpet, I would have been fourth trumpet, but I don't think there is such a thing, so I was kind of always third trumpet.
You know, I played wah-wah pedal, improvised rock and roll sound for the instructor for the jazz program, and he got really pissed off.
Oh, well, yeah, at least you tried. We had a piano in the house. My sister got piano lessons. I think she kind of hated it, so it traumatized my parents. So they didn't even suggest I take any piano lessons. So I ended up playing around with it and doing it, trying to teach myself. I could play a Windy on the piano, just no chords. Cause, you know, I couldn't teach myself chords for some reason. So I had little things like that. Anyway, it's been lovely reminiscing. It's been lovely talking. I hope everyone enjoyed this segment tonight, and I hope you'll come back next Sunday for when we try it all over again. But it's already 10:30 and time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Very good, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet Report with the TechNet. And by the way, I was no blogging at the guitar either. We got to go. It skipped a generation. My daughter turned out to be very good at music. I just wanted to bring up the Europa Clipper. See, last Sunday, the Europa Clipper was scheduled to go up the next day, and sure it did on Monday. And off it went. It's the biggest, heaviest spacecraft to go to deep space. You know, we've had many spacecraft that have done that, you know, Voyagers, Pioneers, Horizon, New Horizon, Galileo spacecraft, Cassini. Now we have one in orbit around Jupiter, the Juno, which is quite large. This thing, way larger, much larger than that. And the solar panels alone, by the way, this spacecraft, Europa Clipper is on the way to Jupiter. The goal is to scan Europa, the moon of one of the moons of Jupiter. But panels are so big, if you were to open them up, they're around 50 feet on each side, plus with the center of the spacecraft itself, you're looking at, like, you know, 110 feet. You know, and they show a drawing of what it looks like compared to the Statue of Liberty. So if you turn the solar panels instead of on, you know, on a horizontal look, a vertical look, it would be up to the shoulder of the Statue of Liberty. So, you know, quite large. The amount of wattage that you get out of it, well, if it was around Earth, you know, four, like 20, 30, 40,000 watts, you know, but you only get 3.5% of what you get in orbit around Earth when you go out to Jupiter. You know, Jupiter is, you know, roughly 5 AU astronomical units, where Earth is 1. So, roughly five times the distance as Earth is from the Sun. And with the inverse square law, and you do the math and everything, you get down to like 3.5-4% of what you would get from the Sun here. So you need these big solar panels for this mission. And the panels out there will produce around 750 watts, which is more than enough. They have lithium-ion batteries on board, and they'll constantly be recharging those batteries. Now, it won't get out to Jupiter and Europa until like 2030, end of 2030. It won't be doing real science probably until 2031. The idea is to orbit Jupiter. And by the way, they're going to do they said 49 orbits of Jupiter, but of course that could be extended. But 49 orbits of Jupiter. Every time it goes around, it'll pass the moon Europa, and each time get closer and closer. When they really get close, as the years go on, they'll get as close as 16 miles above the surface of the moon. All kinds of instruments on board. You know, naturally, you're going to have a whole bunch of different cameras, wide angle lenses, and high resolution cameras. And then you get your spectrometers and all of that to determine, you know, what the ice is, you know, what that's really made of, many minerals that might be on the surface. And what I like about it has these big, long antennas attached to the solar panels. When they open up, like I said, each one is like 50 feet on each side, and about 20 feet away from the center. They've got these long dipoles on each one. And they're going to transmit on multiple frequencies. One I find interesting, plus one of them is going to be around, it looks like 80 meters. And the idea is to transmit down through the ice, or actually hit the ice through the ice, and then have it reflect back up. Now, they'll also receive those same signals. And they'll be able to determine how thick that ice is. And also, they're also trying to determine how deep the water is. They think the water might go down 10, 15 miles. So you take that in a sphere, and if you total it up, the water inside Europa is equal to more than all the water on Earth, all the oceans put together. You know, how is that possible? You know, here on Earth, the water might go down, 2-3 miles in some spaces. Mariana Trench, I think, is the deepest. I think that's something like maybe 20,000 feet or something, 4 miles. But on Europa, they're looking at, you know, very deep ocean, 10, 15 miles. They're really not sure, they're gonna, you know, how deep it goes, but they know it's at least that. So with the minerals and the heat that's generated from the gravitational pull as the moon goes around Jupiter, it's a bit elongated. So, you know, every time it gets closer, there's more pull on the planet, on the moon, and further away less. And this goes, you know, happens every 3 days. The planet, I think it's 3.5 days. So, you know, you're gaining heat, you know, over eons of time. So they think there's some amount of heat inside the moon. You team that up with water. And you team that up with minerals, and the theory is, you know, you could possibly have some kind of biological life inside. Your Europa Clipper is not going to be able to pick up that signature. The signature that it could pick up would be showing that it has all the properties that would support life. There's an instrument on board, too, that will actually test molecules. You know, there's no lander involved, but as it goes overhead, Europa has been known to shoot up plumes, you know, thousands of miles into the air, plumes of water and minerals. Instead of a geyser, you know, with lava, they have geysers with water. And if they time things right, if one happens to be going off when they're passing it, they have the detector that will be able to analyze what that plume of water might be. You know, what happens is releasing, you know, 1,000 tons of water at one time in vapor. But because it's going up, it's going to pull minerals with it. So they'll be able to find out what the inside of Europa might be like. You know, with that going around Jupiter, and then the European Space Agency has one on the way, another good-sized mission called JUICE. They're going to do some analytical investigation with that moon, Europa, as well as Ganymede. The ultimate goal of the JUICE mission is to actually orbit Ganymede. You know, that's one of the other moons of, you know, one of the other Galilean moons. You have four Galilean moons. The one closest in was Io, and then you have Europa, and then you have Ganymede, and then past that you have Callisto. Ganymede is important because that's actually the largest moon in the solar system, bigger than our moon. And that's going to help Europa Clipper when it gets near Jupiter. They're going to use that for gravity assist to actually to slow the spacecraft down to some degree to help it get into orbit around Jupiter. So, we'll see what happens with this. It launched on a Falcon Heavy. That was three Falcon rockets put together. And it ran in the expendable configuration. Most of the Falcon Heavy launches, they'll take the two boosters, stop it in the port, and they'll return it to the Cape, and it will land in landing zone one, which SpaceX took over years ago. They have two big concrete, like the gigantic two concrete round patios that these things land on, and they took over at Launch Complex 13, you know, from Cape Canaveral years ago. But in this case, they're not going to save those boosters. They let them going to the drink in the Atlantic Ocean, along with the core up the dock and heavy. That one always gets, you know, they don't keep that. They tried to keep it the first one, but that didn't work out. So anytime they launch a Falcon Heavy with the three Falcon 9s, the core, the center one, always goes into the drink. And the other two usually get recovered, but they needed all the they could muster with this thing. It weighs like almost 7,000 pounds. And they needed as much power as they could to get this into orbit. And even with that, it's got a couple of gravitational assists to get there. It's first going to go out past Mars in a couple of months. And Mars will give it a little boost, and then it'll keep going all the way around the sun, come back. It's going to find Earth again, catch up to Earth. And then it's going to use Earth as another gravitational assist, and that will give it, you know, if that more thousands of miles to it, they'll be able to take that 1,000-mile-an-hour speed, add that to the existing speed, and that would be enough to push them all the way out to Jupiter. And, you know, they did the math on this, and it should work out okay by 2031. Years ago, when they were designing this spacecraft, you know, 12, 15 years ago, they had plans on sending it up on a space launch system, you know, one of the new rockets that NASA is building, which they've launched one time so far, you know, last November, no, two Novembers ago, 2022, when they launched the Orion spacecraft, which is a crewed spacecraft, but without a crew, and it went all the way around the moon, came back with a 25-day mission. That rocket, the Space Launch System, they were going to use that because it's much more powerful than the Falcon 9 Heavy. You know, you're looking at, you know, almost 10 million pounds of thrust compared to around six, maybe 5.5 million pounds of thrust with the Falcon Heavy. And they would not have needed the gravitational assist of Mars or Earth. And it could have made a direct flight right to Jupiter. It would have been there much sooner. But unfortunately, Space Launch System was not ready in time, so they contracted out with SpaceX years ago. Anyway, that's the story in Europa Clipper. If anybody has any questions, this is WS2N. Okay. Nothing heard. I know Jerry says he won't be back until maybe next week. He's always got good questions. Axiom. Axiom is a company that is planning to have their own space station in the future. Right now they're built that will attach to the International Space Station to be followed by around three other modules in the future. And the idea is that when ISS is decommissioned, whatever that might be, they said 2030, now they're saying maybe 2031. But whenever it's decommissioned, whatever new modules Axiom sends up, they plan on separating from the space station and becoming their own space station. It's going to have its own solar panels, it's going to have its own robotic arm, it's going to have all kinds of docking ports, it's going to have a much bigger cupola than what they have on the space station. The cupola is a big window thing that the astronauts get to look out. It's one with the it's got six trapezoid-shaped windows with a big round 1 meter window in the middle. And this thing will even be bigger. So we'll see how Axiom does with that. But they're doing other things. One of the things Axiom doing is building the the spacesuits that astronauts will walk around on the moon. You know, they can't use the old ones from the 1970s, you know, and they're not going to use the ones that astronauts use on the International Space Station. Those things are getting dated. You know, early 1980 technology. So Axiom has built their own. In fact, they got involved with Prada to help the design of it. But they've come a long way. These things are multi-million-dollar projects just to even try to develop one of these suits. But the cost will probably be, you know, by the time they're done, maybe 10% of what the astronauts use today of the course. So that's under development. It's got a big backpack, similar to what the astronauts used in the 70s. 8 hour supply of water and oxygen. It's got CO2 scrubbers on board. You know, when you exhale, your carbon dioxide has to go somewhere. So that gets pushed through the scrubbers. You know, it's got enough battery power to keep the astronauts warm. And, nice helmet that they have, where they're going to get, almost 180 degree visibility when you look through. So cameras, have cameras on board, similar to what NASA has now with their cameras. As they walk around, mission control will be able to see what they see. So it's under development. They're going through some final testing now. They're going to need these things, by the time they decide to land on the moon. Earliest projection is 2026. I'm throwing that out the window. I'm going with 2028. There's always delays. That's my guess. But, even that would be good. They'll probably shoot for 2026. They'll probably be happy if they get 2027. But I'm going to say, the way it goes, 2028 is going to be WS2N's guess. Any comments? And the shoes, of course, will be not necessary if they decide to use these suits for, the different space stations that are going to be going up there. They won't need these heavy boots that they need to walk around on the moon. But that would be pretty much the only design change. They would, of course, install what they call them safe units, which are like manned maneuvering units, in case you drift away from the space station and somehow you get untethered. You would be able to use these nitrogen jets to get yourself back to the ISS or one of the new space stations, one of the many new space stations. They're playing Axiom, like I said, is one. There's another one called Haven that's being built right now. They're going to launch one module next year, and then there's going to be an upgraded version of Haven in the next couple of years, and they're going to be able to put multiple modules together. That's their plan. European Space Agency has a big plan. They're dealing with Airbus to build a big space station. And there's Sierra Nevada, they teamed up with Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin to build a massive space station, which will be able to hold 10 people on a regular basis. Give you an idea, ISS usually holds around 7. They do more than that, of course, now and then. We'll see what happens in the next couple of years. think they all have to get funded to some degree. I think, there's a lot of delays, probably because of the elections. They don't know who's going to be in office. Seems that every time we get near a big election like this, there's always a slowdown in some of these space activities. I mean, there's a lot going on, but I think there's going to be a lot more going on starting in January, February. Any comments? I just put a fan onto my radio. Wind up cooking that. The crew that's on board the International Space Station right now, you have 11 people. There's four that were planned to come back almost two weeks ago, but due to the bad weather in the Gulf of Mexico and off the southern coast of Florida in the Atlantic Ocean, that bad weather, and then it, of course, got a lot worse with the hurricanes, with Milton. And even now, apparently there's some rough seas there. They've been delaying that. It looks like the 23rd might be the day that crew will be coming back on a SpaceX vehicle. They've been up there for 6 months, and hopefully they'll get back someday soon. You know, so it's almost like you have six people stranded up there. You have these four people, and then you have the other two from Starliner that are still up there. They'll be up there until February. They had another crew come up. Instead of four people, they came up with two people to give them two extra seats, and they'll stay on station until, like I said, February, and then all four will then come back. Starliner, they're still not giving up with the NASA administrator, Bill Nelson. He's still saying publicly a couple days ago that Starliner is still being planned to eventually fly up to the space station again. But, there's possible talk of another test flight. We'll see what happens with that. They might have to do that. When I say they, Boeing is really behind that vehicle. But when they launch, it's not just Boeing. The United Launch Alliance is a combination of Boeing and Lockheed. You know, they work together on a launch vehicle. Launch vehicle is the Atlas V. And still to be retired, I think they have 14 more flights that are planned. And after that, that's it. They'll be completely replaced by the Vulcan rocket. You know, and so far, I think it's had two flights. The brand new design, the BE-4 engines built by Jeff Bezos, Blue Origin, those engines flew flawlessly, you know, 100%. And, they had some trouble with the solid booster rocket built by Northrop Grumman, but that had nothing to do with these new design engines by Blue Origin, which is great because Blue Origin is planning to launch their big rocket, the New Glenn, very soon. It was supposed to go off in the middle of October, but they weren't going to make that date. Like a lot of things, they had some issues that they were trying to work through. But now that's planned for middle of November. That should be interesting because instead of the Vulcan having two BE-4 engines built by Blue Origin, they plan on having seven engines on the big one, the big rocket. Called the New Glenn. So I'm really looking forward to that thing taking off. You know, they're going to try real interesting first. First rocket, so, you know, it's designed to be reusable. And on the first try, they're not going to run in the expendable mode. They're going to run in the let's try and land this thing back on a barge mode and then become reusable right from the start. So that's going to be interesting to see if they can succeed in doing that. They have many, many plans for flights to manifest for Blue Origin. They have 30 to, I heard one guy say 60 flights planned. So they really got to get going. It's going to be reusable first stage vehicles. Second stage, not reusable, not now, but in the future they do have plans on eventually having the second stage reusable too. But that's probably 3-4 years away. We'll see. Any comments at all? This is WS2N for the Space Net Report. Okay, nothing else. Let's see, Firefly. Let me just mention Firefly does have a new contract, government contract, and that's one of the new companies. They've launched 2 flights so far, and they have many flights on their manifest. They plan on doing more and more. They have medium lift vehicles presently launching out of California, Vandenberg. They also plan on eventually launching out of Wallops Island with a new heavier vehicle that's under design that they're working with Northrop Grumman, so there's plenty of money there to do that. So we'll see. We'll follow Firefly along. They have the new Ghost, they call it. That's going to be a lander. They plan on landing on a that's not going to be launched by Firefly, probably SpaceX. And that lander is planned to, I think that's supposed to go early next year. We'll see. We'll keep you informed as time goes on. I'm looking at the clock. Nobody has any comments. We'll turn this back over to Roy. Okay, nothing heard. I'm sure Elon Musk is probably getting ready to do his 6th flight with that Starship. But that was really something. I think I talked about that last week when they caught that thing, the booster coming back with those big arms. So we'll see if they can do that again. And now they're planning on doing the same to the Starship itself, to the upper stage, the one that landed vertically in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Australia last time. And, you know, exactly where they planned on doing that, to the point where they had a buoy out there waiting for the spacecraft to come down. And they filmed it. It was at night. You could see it quite clearly. So we'll see if they could catch both of these vehicles. They do have 2 launch towers built out in Texas. So they would have that capability. One could come down, land there, and the other one to come back would definitely have to go into orbit. And they're going to roll the dice on that one. And then that will, have to also come back to Boca Chica, Texas to land. That would be a very big accomplishment if they could do that. We'll turn this back over to Roy. We'll try to be on tomorrow night for the Club Net and the Swap and Shop. Roy, over to you. AT2GSWS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, this is AC2GS. Our rebels now are done. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the space.